Tom Brown's body, set in the panhandle town of Canadian. When a popular high school student disappeared in 2016, many residents joined the search on foot and horseback. But 4 years on, with the case still unsolved, Skip notes much of the town has devolved into finger-pointing and baseless accusations, setting neighbor against neighbor. The story is so full of twists that we're publishing it in installments across 3 consecutive print issues, in smaller bites on our website, and this weekly 8-episode podcast available at texasmonthly.com starting on September 29th. Skip has been working on the piece for 9 months, and he says he's had to develop new muscles to translate it into a podcast. Skip, a 31-year veteran of Texas Monthly, tells stories the way many Texans do when they're catching up with friends over coffee. His writing is restrained yet vivid. He doesn't do a lot of explaining. He instead hews closely to the facts, turned up by his prodigious reporting. Skip casts a wide net with his interviews and pores over police and court records. He observes body language and the smell of a place. He has empathy for everyone from politicians to murderers. I'm just curious about why they are the way they are, he says, especially those who seem much like the rest of us, but then one day walk up to the line of accepted behavior and step across it. Son of a Presbyterian minister and a homemaker who said being a minister's wife was her life's calling, Skip was born in North Carolina and moved to Wichita Falls when he was 11. Women in the congregation often sought counsel from his mother, Peggy, and Skip learned to interview from her. He would eavesdrop as Peggy asked visitors direct, concise questions about their lives. Peggy knew the best answers often came after a pause. She knew, Skip says, to just wait and not interrupt. After graduating from Texas Christian University, Skip worked as a Metro reporter, as a sports writer, and briefly as a TV producer. That taught me that the way to keep people interested in the story was to write as visually as possible through scenes. Unsurprisingly, Ford Skip's Texas Monthly stories have been made into movies, including 2011's Bernie, directed by Texan Richard Linklater. Whenever you're in the mood for a great read, do yourself a favor and Google Skip Hollinsworth Texas Monthly. The first search result should take you to a page on our website where we've archived most of Skip's work. Just pick a story at random. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy Tom Brown's Body. Please let me know what you think of it and the rest of this issue. You can write Mr. Good Game on the internet at roar@texasmonthly.com. Now we turn to State, and this is Traveling Outdoors. It's Excursions by Pam LeBlanc. A million years ago, otherwise known as early March, when the prospect of hopping on a bicycle didn't require a plan for disinfectant social distancing, I drove to Palmetto State Park near Gonzales with my husband and a friend. We paid our entrance fee, parked the car, and climbed onto our bikes, pedaling south of the park on FM 2091 for a mile before turning onto a network of gravel roads. We rolled past chicken farms, fields of wildflowers, and barking dogs. We tugged north over a rusty iron bridge, then looped back toward the park, stopping to chat with a very vocal donkey, and checked out the old warm springs in Ottheim. For more than 30 miles, only a handful of motorists passed us. For me, that's the appeal of gravel grinding, a laid-back category of bicycling that takes riders off paved streets where cars can whiz past at 60 miles an hour and onto rural routes where they're more likely to encounter a slowly whirling windmill or curious farm animals. Because gravel riders pedal roads that, though not paved, are built for motor vehicles, they won't encounter the cyclists launching obstacles, boulders, roots, rocky ledges that mountain bikers love to conquer. Almost any sturdy bike with wide tires will do, although built-for-gravel bikes have become all the rage. With a more relaxed riding position and frames that are beefier than fine-boned road bikes, but not as rugged as the mountain variety. Compared with mountain bikers and other types of cyclists, gravel grinders pedal at a relatively leisurely pace, but the miles come harder for grinders than they do for road cyclists, thanks to bumpy roads that serve up more rolling resistance. Grinders generally have a more chill attitude about racing, too. The pros mix with the Joes, as 38-year-old gravel rider John Wilmeth of New Waverly told me at last year's Castell Gravel Grind, one of the biggest gravel events in Texas, while we enjoyed the post-race ritual of chili, baked potatoes, and beer. I've been logging lots of gravel miles since the pandemic hit, crunching over lightly trafficked roads around central Texas on my mustard-colored gravel bike. Near Luling one day, a snarling dog came barreling out of a fenced-in yard and straight into my path, nearly pitching me off my seat. I just managed to avoid crashing, and I learned a valuable lesson. Carry a can of dog repellent to ward off unfriendly pups in rural areas. Usually, though, I get lost in the solitude, rolling across an old iron bridge outside Luling, stopping to pet a horse near Smithville, checking out a pump jack in Page. In non-pandemic years, you might find me at events like the aforementioned Castell Gravel Grind, which draws hundreds of like-minded cyclists looking to pound out some country miles and then kick back with a cold one and some grub. Austin residents Mike Drost, Debbie Richardson, and Janie Gloss have put on paddling and adventure races across Texas for more than a decade and started the Castell Grind in 2014 after exploring the infrequently traveled roads around the small town, which is 20 miles west of Llano. I think it's the most scenic place you can ride in Texas, Drost said, noting that the grind route starts and finishes at the bright yellow Castell General Store, funnels cyclists along the Llano River for 8 miles, and features views of House Mountain, Kings Mountain, and Bodie Peak. Participants choose from three distances, 100, 75, or 50 kilometers, all of which include a spin up notorious Kaiserville Road, where, as veterans put it, the carnage happens, with cyclists slogging uphill through the sand. It's worth it, though. Instead of just riding flat on farmland, you're actually riding toward something, Drost says, of the mountains. When they're not racing, Drost and his partners also like riding around Lockhart, 33 miles southeast of Boston. They park their cars on the historic town square, pedal for hours along the nearby spiderweb of hard-packed gravel roads, then finish with barbecue at a classic spot like Black's Barbecue, Kreutz Market, or Smitty's Market before heading home. For Drost, the biggest advantage of gravel riding is avoiding traffic. You feel much safer, even though you're remote, he says of the isolation. The cars slow down because they don't want to kick up rocks. You can go out and just three or four cars pass you. Gravel riding has become trendy over the past few years. It attracts road racers bored with the endless closed-circuit laps of criterium races, endurance athletes who want to spend long hours on a bike, and mountain bike racers eager for new scenery instead of repetitive loops, says Fort Worth's Kevin Lee, founder of the Spinistry, which stages about 24 gravel events in North and Central Texas. The Spinistry's first gravel ride happened by accident in 2010. Lee was hosting the Red River Riot, an endurance mountain biking race at a private ranch. When a big storm hit, he switched the route to keep the riders off the narrow trails, which had quickly become unnavigable, and onto the better-draining dirt and gravel roads. I was crying in my beer, thinking they'd hate me, he recalls, but the riders started coming in, covered head to toe in mud, and all you could see were teeth because they were smiling. Unlike states including Kansas and Michigan, which have hosted well-known gravel events for years, Texas has a premier gravel scene that is more under the radar. People in Texas don't have to go across the country to get in a good gravel ride, Lee says. Although events build camaraderie, the beauty of gravel riding is that it's available to almost anyone, almost anywhere in the state. The rolling terrain and scenic ranches of the hill country, spliced by lightly traveled roads, and the Red River Valley, sometimes called the North Texas Hill Country, are big draws. A few places like Lockhart and Luling are known for hard-packed roads. Around LaGrange, cyclists tackle golf ball-sized gravel that's rough under saddle. Near Bastrop, gravel grinders can pedal past the historic Antioch Cemetery. Other regions serve up their own flavor of gravel riding. The piney woods around Palestine feature shady, gently rolling hills, and the prickly Chihuahuan desert of the Big Bend Ranch State Park offers rugged but exhilarating terrain. Lately, though, some city-dwelling cyclists are having to drive a little further to find gravel as fast-growing counties expand their network of paved roads. Lee, for example, has had to move his most popular event, the Texas Chain Ring Massacre, increasingly north of Fort Worth. Still, he says, there's plenty of dirt roads out there for people to go out and have a gravel adventure. That's good news for enthusiasts such as 35-year-old Stephanie Martinez, an Austin paralegal who discovered gravel riding about 3 years ago. Now she volunteers to lead women's rides on Central Texas gravel roads and participates in organized rides, including the Castell Gravel Grind. What I like about it is it's not as hard as mountain biking, which can get very technical, she says. In other words, you won't have to thread your way between jagged chunks of limestone or pop up and down stone ledges if you stick to gravel roads. A lot of people have been switching to gravel because mountain biking is too technical and road riding is too dangerous with cars and accidents, It's peaceful. It's serene. It's a really good environment. Five great routes. It's a little sidebar here. Pedal past some stunning views and historic sites. Fast drop for a mostly gravel 35-mile spin through the pine groves and rolling farmland northeast of Bastrop State Park. Ride Goatier Trace and Antioch Roads toward Page. Pooling in Gonzales, begin your relatively flat 38-mile cruise at Palmetto State Park, crossing the San Marcos River via the Sladen Bridge. Wind your way to Harwood, parallel to Interstate 10, before turning back on County Road 230. Palestine in East Texas, the undulating El Camino 105 route, so named for its 105 miles, although it's actually 107, through Grapeland, Latexo, and Mission Tejas State Park, intersects an old Spanish and indigenous trade route. West Texas, at Big Bend National Park, bike Old Maverick Road from the Maverick Junction entrance station to Santa Elena Canyon, about 14 miles each way. The improved dirt road cuts the Terlingua Creek Badlands and descends to the Rio Grande. And around Castell, you can brave the sands of Kaiserville Road as it rolls for 9 miles south of the tiny town where the Castell General Store serves up a fine smoked chicken. Next, we're going to turn to that lead story. This is a feature article. It's a cover story for this month's edition of Texas Monthly, Tom Brown's Body. In 2016, a popular teenager disappeared in the tiny panhandle community of Canadian. 2 years later, his remains were discovered beneath a tree outside of town. To this day, no arrest had been made, and it seems nearly everyone involved in the case has fallen under suspicion. By Skip Hollingsworth. First part, A Pretty Little Place. When I first drove into the two-stop light town of Canadian, it reminded me of a lot of small Texas communities I've been to. Canadian is a pretty little place hidden away in a remote northeastern corner of the Texas Panhandle, set next to a shallow river surrounded by rolling hills and miles of prairie. As I came into town, I passed by a feed store, water well drilling company, and an oil well service shop. Canadian is dotted with churches and a couple of cafes where the locals drop in for coffee and greet each other by name. There's a well-kept rodeo arena and a downtown theater reminiscent of the movie house in Larry McMurtry's The Last Picture Show. The high school football stadium seats 3,059 spectators, about 360 more than live in the entire population of Canadian. But when I turned onto Main Street, I came across an empty lot with two identical signs, 4 feet tall and 8 feet wide, planted in the ground. Written at the top of each sign in bold red letters was, Justice for Tom. Below that were two sentences, There is a killer among us. Please pray that Tom's killer is found and brought to justice. There was also a photo of a teenage boy. He was wearing glasses, his brown hair is brushed over his forehead, and he was giving the camera a gentle smile. That was Tom, Tom Brown. In the fall of 2016, Tom was 18 years old. He was one of the most popular kids in Canadian, president of his 71-member senior class, a standout in the school's theater program, and an offensive lineman on the football team, which had won the Class 2A Division I state championship the last 2 years. But on the night of November 23rd, Thanksgiving Eve, Tom vanished. Residents spent days on foot, on horseback, on four-wheelers, searching for him in and around Canadian. A couple of local pilots flew their helicopters over nearby pastures and prairie, hoping to spot Tom, but he stayed missing for the next 2 years and 2 months until January 2019, when a sheriff's deputy came across Tom's skull and a few of his bones scattered under a dead cottonwood tree east of town. By that point, four law enforcement agencies, the Hemphill County Sheriff's Department, the Texas Rangers, the FBI, and the Criminal Investigations Division of the Texas Attorney General's Office, had looked into the mystery of Tom's disappearance. Determined to find out who would have reason to hurt Tom, officers had interrogated everyone from a former Canadian high school valedictorian to a running back on the football team. Lie detector tests had been administered to Canadian's sheriff, to a globe-trotting private investigator who had come to Canadian to look into the case, even to members of Tom's family. Still, no arrests had been made. And in August 2019, 7 months after Tom's remains were discovered, Rachel Cadding, a sergeant with the Attorney General's Investigations Unit, who was then in charge of the inquiry, announced that she and her partner were unable to determine the cause of Tom's death and that they would be suspending their work in Canadian, pending any newly discovered credible evidence. In other words, the case, for all practical purposes, was closed. I've been following the story from afar, reading articles about Tom in the Amarillo Globe News and the Weekly Canadian Record, and occasionally perusing a Facebook group called Moms for Tom, which had been created by Tom's mother, Penny Meek, and a handful of her friends. I'd talked to the record's editor and publisher, Laurie Brown, no relation to Tom, keeping track of all the gossip that had flourished surrounding Tom's death, that he had committed suicide, that he had been killed accidentally in a fight with a member of the high school football team, that he had been kidnapped by sex traffickers, that he had been ground up in a wood chipper by a local methamphetamine dealer, that he had even been murdered by the county sheriff. "It's nasty, this thing. A complete nightmare," said Laurie, whose family has owned the record since the 40s. "You want to believe that over the last couple of years people have wised up, but apparently not. The conspiracy thinking is rampant." During one of our conversations, Laurie told me that she wasn't sure she'd ever get the chance to write a final article laying out exactly what happened to Tom. "There are too many unanswered questions about the night he had vanished," she said. "Too many unanswered questions about why his remains had ended up under a tree." But this past January, a new rumor started making its way around town. Kading from the Attorney General's office reportedly had been calling people in Canadian and telling them that she would be returning to conduct more interviews. Apparently, the investigation was back on. That's when I decided to come to Canadian. Surely, I figured, someone eventually was going to tell the truth about Tom's death. Someone was bound to reveal what he or she had witnessed or done. As Laurie Brown told me, "I don't think you can do a damn thing in Canadian without somebody seeing you." Like a lot of panhandle communities, Canadian, which is named for the Canadian River that runs north of town, started out as a railroad stop in the late 19th century. It's far away from just about everything. The panhandle's only city, Amarillo, is 100 miles to the west. As a result, Canadian's 2,700 residents are somewhat cloistered. They mostly entertain themselves. The community maintains a public library, swimming pool, skate park, disc golf course, and performance hall for country music concerts and dances. There's a fall foliage festival, a 4th of July rodeo, and an annual calf fry. Canadian even has an art museum that has featured works by the likes of Marc Chagall and Rembrandt. Most little towns, people don't go back to, but in Canadian, it's a nice enough place to grow up. Salem Abraham, who's known as the richest person in town, told me, "It's got great schools, and you say, you know what, Canadian's not so bad. We're all a bunch of folks that have grown up together. Our parents grew up together, and our kids have grown up together. We're all friends." I met Abraham the day I arrived in Canadian. He's a trim, energetic man in his mid-50s, a fourth-generation Canadian resident whose great-grandfather, Naheem Abraham, emigrated from Lebanon, passed through Ellis Island in 1913, and made his way to the Panhandle. He opened a dry goods store in Canadian to serve the area's cattle ranchers and cotton farmers, and the family prospered. Salem Abraham graduated cum laude in finance from Notre Dame University and considered heading to Chicago. Instead, he returned to Canadian to marry his high school sweetheart and raise a family. He launched a hedge fund, which in time became a sensation, with more than $600 million in assets. When I went to see him at his offices, which take up the second and third floors of a renovated century-old former downtown hotel, he was wearing a $300 blue Brioni dress shirt, blue jeans, and hiking boots. He had a list of phone calls he needed to make to his multimillionaire clients, but he gladly dropped what he was doing and gave me as much time as I wanted to talk about Tom. "Tom was a good kid, a sweet kid, a kid that was well-liked," said Abraham, who first got to know Tom while coaching his flag football team back when Tom was a boy. Abraham was clearly upset over Tom's death. He told me that when members of Moms for Tom asked him if they could erect the Justice for Tom signs on the empty lot he happens to own on Main Street, he immediately said yes, even though he knew they would cause a stir. "Clearly, there's a group of people in town that do not like those signs," Abraham said. "They want to move on, and they think, well, this won't define Canadian. You know, we just need to move on. But my way of looking at this is part of our history. It happened, and it's a big deal. And now I think as a community, we need to deal with it. We need to figure it out. We need to solve it. But until then, we can't move on." Before I left Abraham's office, he logged onto his computer and pulled up Google Maps to show me where Tom had last been seen and where his body had been found. He then gave me one piece of advice, that I shouldn't believe everything I was going to hear about Tom and his death. "There's a lot of lying going on," said Abraham. "Lying or just misinformation based on the wrong evidence?" I asked. "Someone is lying," he replied, "and it's hard to know who's lying and who's not." When I dropped by the offices of the Canadian Record, Laurie Brown told me the same thing. "I've seen a lot lot of people pointing fingers in the other direction, trying to cast suspicion, she said. It's quickly become obvious to me that a lot of people weren't telling the truth, that their stories changed and became very self-serving. Laurie, who's in her late 60s, is a bit of an anomaly in conservative Canadian. Hanging on the wall of her office is a framed front page of the New York Times announcing Barack Obama's victory in a 2008 presidential election. But regardless of her political leanings, Laurie is fiercely devoted to her hometown. When we walked inside Alexander's, a combination convenience store in Delhi, to grab lunch, she seemed to know everyone there. She chatted with one woman who promised to send photos of her cattle to accompany an article on livestock in an upcoming issue of the paper. She asked the cashier how her family was doing. When we sat down, though, she admitted that the Tom Brown story had taken something out of her. I've covered this for over 3 years, she said, and I'm still pretty baffled by the whole thing. I just never have felt like I can get anywhere close to what really happened. The more time that's passed, the more frustrating it is that we still know so little, she sighed. It's been hard. I'm tired. I headed off to meet Tom's mother, Penny Meek, a computer technology teacher at Canadian's elementary schools. When I arrived at her ranch-style home on the edge of town, she had just gotten home from work. She was dressed casually in a blouse, blue jeans, and tennis shoes. Her white blonde hair fell to her shoulders. She introduced me to Tom's older brother, Tucker, who's 24, and an information technology specialist at a nearby school district, and to her husband, Chris Meek, a quiet man with thinning hair who works as a line locator for an oil field supply company. Penny and Chris married in 2012 after she had divorced Tom and Tucker's dad, Kelly Brown, in 2006. As I sat down at the kitchen table with Penny and Tucker, Chris served us glasses of tap water. I explained that some of my questions were going to be painful. Are you okay with that? I asked. Yes, Penny quietly said. She told me that she hadn't had a decent night's sleep since Tom disappeared more than 3 years earlier. One reason she couldn't sleep, she explained, was that Tom's remains were still in possession of the Attorney General's office, which meant she hadn't been able to give Tom a proper burial. I don't think we've grieved yet, Penny said. We've had a memorial, but we don't have an autopsy. We don't have a forensics report. We'd have nothing. Penny described Tom as kind, smart, funny, outgoing. As a little boy, he loved pretending he was a pirate. If I was making dinner or whatever, he would just go off by himself and make up all these little plays, she said. He would be all the characters. It was kind of comical. Penny also told me that Tom was one of Canadian's good kids, the kind of teenager who always said yes, sir, and yes, ma'am, when talking to adults. At school, he didn't skip classes. He never caused trouble. He didn't drink much at the high school parties out at Lake Marvin, a small 60-acre reservoir east of town, and his friends said he refused to drink at all when he was the designated driver. Got along with everyone. Football players, the theater students, the farm and ranch kids who were members of the Hemp Hill County 4-H Club. One of his favorite books was The Great Gatsby. He fancied himself a film buff. He loved the edgy classic Clockwork Orange. He played Xbox Live with friends, and he religiously watched Monday Night Raw, the professional wrestling television show. Tom, who was 6'1" and 180 pounds, told his friends, and he was not completely joking, that he might someday go to a wrestling school and become a professional himself, combining his athletic and dramatic skills. He was quirky, said Christian Webb, a former Canadian High valedictorian who was one of Tom's best friends. He knew how to make people laugh, and he loved to do it, and I think that's what attracted people to him. That's what attracted me to him. He was just a sweet, charismatic guy. So I don't think I knew a single person that truly said, I just don't like that guy, added Caleb King, who comes from one of Canadian's most prominent families. Caleb's father, Ken, runs an energy service company and is a Republican member of the Texas House of Representatives. I never knew anybody who had an issue with him. He was our president. Indeed, in the fall of 2016, Tom seemed to have everything going for him. Besides being elected senior class president, he had been selected to play a leading role in the upcoming school play, The History of Tom Jones, based on the comic English novel by Henry Fielding. He was taking a full load of classes and filling out college applications. In October, he did raise some eyebrows when he quit the football team. Tom, who had been backup lineman during the previous two state championship seasons, had been named a starter for 2016, but after a few games, the coaches had demoted him back to second team. Tom didn't seem particularly upset. He told the coaches he was sorry, but he didn't want to stand on the sidelines for the rest of the year. And in November, he broke up with a Canadian girl he'd been seeing named Sage Pennington. But as far as anyone could tell, he didn't seem particularly upset by that either. Sage was a year ahead of Tom in school, a freshman majoring in education at West Texas A&M University in Canyon, a two-hour drive away. Tom explained to his family that it was hard to keep up a long-distance relationship, but he said that he and Sage had promised to remain good friends. He insisted there were no hard feelings. A little natural spot here to take a break and remind you that you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Site in the Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. Listen to Sight into Town on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight into Town Radio since 1967. Now, back to our text. Then came the evening of November 23rd. Tom made plans to cruise around Canadian with his friends. Before he left home, he borrowed his mother's debit card so he could fill up his red 2009 Dodge Durango. He drove to the Canadian Middle School parking lot where he met Caleb King and another high school buddy named Michael Castletine. Caleb and Michael piled into Tom's Durango and Tom coasted around town following his usual route, a series of streets that his friends had coined Tom's Loop. Michael told me it was a typical night. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. The boys talked, listened to music, and stopped at Alexander's for a quick dinner. At 8 p.m., they returned to the middle school parking lot to meet Christian Webb. Michael said he was calling it a night, and he left in his car. Tom and Caleb climbed into Christian's silver Dodge Charger. Christian had graduated from Canadian High the previous spring and was attending Oklahoma State University on a scholarship, studying microbiology and playing the piccolo in the marching band. That Thanksgiving weekend was the first time she'd been home since the fall semester began. She noticed that Tom was in great spirits. He seemed really happy, she told me. At one point that night, Tom asked Christian if he could play a couple of songs by the popular Americana band, the Avett Brothers. One song was called Live and Die, the other was No Hard Feelings. Later, they stopped by what locals call the Walking Bridge, an old wagon bridge just outside of town that was now part of a hike and bike trail. It was cold, in the upper 30s. There was a brisk breeze coming from the southwest. Tom was wearing a thin black pullover, a black Canadian Wildcats t-shirt, faded jeans, and tennis shoes. As they strolled across the bridge, Christian took his photograph, and Tom smiled. The three teenagers returned to the middle school parking lot between 11 and 11:15. Caleb left for his house. Christian and Tom lingered, making plans for Tom to come over to her house the next day to play pool. They also talked about Tom visiting her sometime at Oklahoma State. I told him that it was really good to hang out with him, and he said the exact same thing to me, recalled Christian. Then Tom drove away in his Durango. We're at section two of this story. It's entitled Tom's Loop. At the stroke of midnight, Penny checked her phone. Midnight was Tom's curfew, and according to Penny, Tom was rarely late. If he was going to miss curfew by a few minutes, he always called her or texted her to let her know, but that night she hadn't heard from him. Penny said she called and texted Tom. Tom's brother, Tucker, who was in the living room watching a movie with his friend Taylor Russell, did the same, and Tom didn't answer. At around 12:30, Penny woke her husband, Chris, and told him she was going to look for Tom. She grabbed her keys and climbed into her Chevy Suburban. Tucker and Taylor piled into Tucker's Toyota 4Runner. Penny drove around town while Tucker scoured the surrounding highways and Farnham Market roads. He said he feared Tom had been in an accident. You know, if that's what's happened, we could get him some help and save his life, Tucker told me. After an hour or so, Tucker said he dropped Taylor off at his house, and then he continued searching for Tom for another hour. Meanwhile, Penny returned home and called the Kings to ask if Caleb had any idea where Tom might be. Caleb was taken aback. He knew his friend to always make it home by curfew, so he called Michael Castletine, who also said he had no idea what had happened. Caleb then hung up and dialed Christian. My first thought was that he had just gotten a flat tire, Christian later told me. I mean, nothing ever happens in Canadian, nothing terrible. So, I mean, I was concerned, but I didn't have a huge amount of concern. Caleb, Michael, and Christian each got in their own cars to search for Tom. Caleb was accompanied by his mother. They drove everywhere, downtown, the football stadium, the rodeo arena, even out to Lake Marvin, the reservoir east of Canadian that's surrounded by campsites and picnic areas. At roughly 2:30 a.m. on Thanksgiving morning, Penny called the Sheriff's Department in Canadian to report Tom as missing. There is no local police department. The dispatcher relayed the news to a deputy on duty named Pine Gregory. According to the report later filed by Gregory, he first drove around town looking for Tom's Durango. Then around 4 a.m., he pulled up to the Meeks home. Penny, Pris, and Tucker met the deputy on the front porch. Maybe, they suggested, Tom had gone to see Sage Pennington, the girl he had recently stopped dating. They'd heard she was home for Thanksgiving weekend. Tucker told Gregory he'd ride along and show him where Sage lived, about 8 miles outside of town. When they arrived, Tom's Durango wasn't there. 7:30 a.m., Penny and Pris were on their way to see Nathan Lewis, the sheriff of Hemp Hill County, of which Canadian is the county seat. Lewis is a handsome 32-year-old with short red hair and a neatly trimmed beard. Residents say he looks exactly like the NASCAR driver Dale Earnhardt Jr., a native of Canadian. His father used to be mayor. Lewis began working for small-town Panhandle Police Department when he was in his early 20s. In September 2016, he took over as sheriff of Hemp Hill County after campaigning on a war on drugs platform, telling voters that he and his deputies would stop at nothing to bring down the drug dealers scattered around the county, which is 900 square miles in size. Lewis quickly proved to be good at drug busts. He started making arrests soon after he was sworn into office that September, but he had never conducted a missing persons case, and suddenly here he was talking to Penny about her son, where he might have gone. Lewis and Penny knew one another. They and her families both attended First United Methodist Church, but they weren't exactly friends, and it all had to do with Tom. Just a year earlier, in 2015, Lewis was working as a sheriff's deputy in a neighboring county. Late one night, driving back to his home in Canadian, he noticed a handful of teenagers, including Tom, hanging around the Palace movie theater. Lewis suspected they were up to no good. He ordered Tom into his truck. I said, Tom, what the hell are y'all doing? Lewis told me, you guys need to get y'all's butts home. Tom told Penny a different story. He said that he and his friends were only looking for a friend whose father ran the theater and that Lewis had accosted him. Penny was so upset that she filed a complaint against Lewis with the sheriff's department. Although it went nowhere, Lewis insisted that he had not mistreated Tom. Penny began telling her friends that Lewis should never become sheriff of Hemp Hill County. I felt like if he was elected sheriff, that's what he was going to do to our kids in the community all the time, she said, like he was just going to mess with them. When I spoke to Lewis, he said he didn't begrudge Penny over the movie theater incident. He said that when she and Chris arrived at his office worried about Tom, he treated them with respect, but he admitted he was initially skeptical that Tom really was missing. To be honest with you, I figured that we had a high school kid who went out and partied and didn't come home on time, Lewis said. Not long after their meeting, however, Lewis got a phone call. Tom's Durango had been found. Earlier that morning, Christian Webb and her father, Trey, a well-to-do Canadian resident who owns a helicopter sales and service company, had decided to search for Tom in one of the company's four-seater helicopters. Trey was an experienced pilot, and he hovered low to the ground, crisscrossing Canadian and the surrounding area. He and Christian spotted Tom's red Durango parked under a small grove of trees across a dirt road from the water treatment plant just north of town. It was a strange place to find the vehicle, Christian said. She had no idea the dirt road even existed, and I was almost sure that Tom didn't know about it. We never drove up to that point at all. After getting the call, Lewis raced to the scene. He and a deputy approached the Durango. We walked around the car several times, looking around, he said. There was nobody in the car. Then we started circling around, you know, kind of looking in the area to see if we could see anything, find anything. Because it hadn't rained for several days, the ground was still packed and not conducive to footprints. Still, Lewis said, he and the deputy did spot one light shoe print outside the driver's door. They also noticed what looked like to be a urine mark near the same door. Scattered inside the Durango, which was unlocked, were cans of smokeless tobacco, two pairs of football cleats, towels, jumper cables, a pillow, and a clown costume, which Tom had worn for a school drama production, Penny later told me. There was no sign of his wallet, his keys, his cell phone, or his mother's debit card. Lewis, however, did spy Michael Castletine's debit card, which had fallen between the front seats, and it was a thin streak of blood on the inside of the front driver's door by the handle. It looked like it was probably a knuckle cut or something, or a finger cut or paper cut, he said. It was very dry. There was one other thing Lewis and his deputy discovered, a 25 caliber shell casing on the floorboard. Lewis said he was confounded because, as far as he could tell, there was nothing in the car that said there was a gunshot that went off in that car. There was no splatter, there was no gunpowder residue in the car, there was nothing. Within minutes, the news about Tom's abandoned Durango was racing through town like a prairie fire. Some residents postponed their Thanksgiving meals, drove to the water treatment plant, and started searching for Tom on foot, horseback, and four-wheelers. Trey and Christian Webb continued scanning for Tom from their helicopter, and Webb's son, Emmett, joined the search in a second helicopter. He Game wardens arrived with a tracking dog, but no one spotted Tom, and the dog couldn't find a scent to follow. As the day wore on, friends and neighbors dropped by Penny's house with leftover turkey and pumpkin pie and words of encouragement. Tom and Tucker's father, Kelly Brown, a bank examiner, drove in from Perryton, 46 miles to the northwest. I was shaking so bad I couldn't stand it, he told me. At some point that afternoon, Sheriff Lewis talked to Penny. He asked if anyone in her family owned a 25 caliber pistol. No, she said. And then he just said he was returning the car, Penny said. I said, why are you bringing the car back? And he said, well, we're done with it. We don't need it anymore. I said, you're telling me you processed the car? You got fingerprints or whatever from the car? Well, we don't need it anymore, he told me. I said, okay. When the Durango arrived, Tucker did his own examination of the vehicle and found nothing out of the ordinary. But the next morning, Lewis ordered that the Durango be towed back to the sheriff's department. He told me that he had spent a sleepless night thinking he should inspect the Durango one more time to make sure no evidence was overlooked. We did everything again, he said. We re-wiped the blood spot. We went and we put more ink on that car, fingerprint dust, than you can imagine to make sure that we didn't miss anything. Actually, something was missing, which no one noticed until the superintendent of Canadian Public Schools dropped by Penny's house to check on her. The superintendent asked if anyone had seen Tom's school computer. If Tom had been using it to get online, he said perhaps it could be traced. Penny said that Tom stowed his computer and his school books in his backpack, which he almost always left in a Durango, unless he needed it to bring inside the house to do homework. She said she hadn't seen it. Tucker mentioned that he hadn't seen the backpack either. Perhaps Tom had taken it with him after leaving the Durango. Attempts to trace Tom's laptop were unsuccessful, but the absence of his backpack was puzzling. Why would Tom park the Durango by the water treatment plant, a place that was supposedly foreign to him, and walk away carrying his wallet, his keys, his cell phone, and his backpack containing his books and laptop? Where in the world would he be going? Or had something else entirely taken place in those early hours of Thanksgiving morning, something that no one could yet imagine? Over the next few days, Sheriff Lewis intensified the search for Tom. He called in veteran bloodhounds from the state prison in Amarillo. The dogs were taken by their handlers to the dirt road where the Durango had been found and were given pieces of Tom's clothes to sniff. They picked up a scent, which they began to follow east to northeast for 3/4 of a mile. But the scent disappeared at the edge of a marshy slough, and the dogs turned back. Lewis also arranged for a grid search. Dozens of people, several of them volunteer firefighters, walked side by side, combing a 2-mile area surrounding the water treatment plant. They turned up nothing. Later, Lewis brought in a mounted search and rescue team from nearby Randall County. They started at the Canadian River and rode their horses east along the river bottoms to Lake Marvin. They couldn't find any sign of Tom either. The truth was that Tom's friends hadn't anticipated that much would come from Lewis's search and rescue efforts. They couldn't imagine Tom getting out of his Durango in the daytime, let alone in darkness, to trek through the woods. That seemed highly impossible to me, said Christian. Tom wasn't an outdoors man at all. He liked having his phone and his video games, and he never did outdoorsy things. And I mean, it was freezing cold that night, and he wasn't wearing many clothes. The clothes he was wearing were really thin. Lewis and his deputies had better luck studying the grainy black and white video footage from security cameras posted around town. On the night Tom disappeared, a camera in front of a convenience store on 2nd Street in the heart of town had captured Tom's Durango just after midnight heading up a street, possibly toward his home, but then coming back down the same street a few minutes later. Around 5:30 a.m., a camera caught the Durango ambling through downtown, turning in the directions of Tom's home and again backtracking. Then at 5:56 a.m., the Durango was picked up by a camera positioned atop a city-owned building near the water treatment plant. It showed the vehicle moving slowly along the dirt road, passing through the already opened gate and parking. Headlights went off. It was total darkness. No one could be seen getting in or out. What had seemed like a potential lead only raised more questions. Why would Tom be driving around Canadian in those early morning hours, dodging his family and friends after the sheriff's deputies who were out looking for him? Why would he drive toward his home? Of all the places he could have chosen to abandon the Durango, why would he pick the water treatment plant? Or what if he hadn't walked into the woods at all? For that matter, what if someone else was driving the car? The afternoon of November 26, Penny and Chris were called in the sheriff's department to be interviewed again. This time, the questioning was handled by Lewis's chief deputy, Brent Clapp, a former Panhandle ranch hand with an Old West handlebar mustache who'd been in law enforcement for more than a decade. A Department of Public Safety state trooper, Clapp knew, also sat in on the conversation. Chris was interviewed first, he said Annie was Tom's main caregiver and that he was basically an observer who mostly talked sports with Tom. He said he had no idea why the boy disappeared. Annie went next. She started off by describing what Tom's friends often said about him, that he was nice to everybody and had a soft heart, especially for the underdog. Said she hadn't noticed any recent changes in his behavior. I mean, nothing. And I've been in contact with several of his teachers, and his teachers have said he was doing great in school. Even the teachers who don't have him in class this year, that maybe had him in past years, were like, I've seen him in the hall, and he's laughing and smiling. The officers then moved on to Tom's disappearance, asking Penny what first came to mind when she heard that Durango had been found at the water treatment plant. Penny didn't hesitate. I thought he committed suicide, she replied. There was a brief silence. Tell me why, the DPS trooper said. Because it runs in my family, Penny explained. And I just figured maybe at that point he was distraught about breaking up with his girlfriend. There was another silence. One of the officers asked Penny how Tom might have killed himself. I figured it would have been like the choking game, she said. The choking game, also known as blackout game or the good kid's high, had garnered occasional headlines over the years. It was most commonly attempted by teenage boys. Someone intentionally strangles himself or someone else, and the lack of oxygen leads to a feeling of euphoria and a brief loss of consciousness, but it has also resulted in accidental deaths. Penny quickly pivoted, telling the officers that she didn't actually know much about the choking game, but the thought randomly occurred to her, she said, because Tom is not a gun person. I'd already checked for guns in the house. All of ours were accounted for. I'd already checked meds. Everything was accounted for. It turned out that Penny's father, suffering from depression, had shot himself to death in 1998, 18 years earlier. So Penny's sensitivity to suicide was understandable. But why, I later asked Penny, was it the first thought that came to mind when Tom went missing? Well, she explained, I was thinking, he's a senior. His boat is loaded as far as academics. He doesn't really know where he wants to go to college, and he's broken up with his girlfriend. I mean, the kid had a lot on his plate. And so, suicide completely out of the realm of possibility? No, not really. I don't think it's out of the realm of any of our high school kids to commit suicide at all. But when I asked if she had ever sensed Tom was depressed, she shook her head. No. His state of mind, even the day that he disappeared, was regular Thomas. I mean, there was nothing different about him that day. So I just don't think that he committed suicide at all. During her interview at the sheriff's department, the officers asked Penny if Tom could have left Canadian with someone she didn't know. Penny said she didn't think so, but she did offer a theory about Tom's disappearance. Maybe Tom had gone off to pursue one of his dreams. This may be a bit of a stretch, Penny said. I don't even know how he would get there, but he tells me he loves WWE wrestling. And, you know, he has asked me before, well, can I be a wrestler? And I'm like, you do whatever you want when you get out of college, you know? And he's like, will you pay for it? And I'm like, I'm paying for college and that's it. As the interview came to a close, Penny sounded hopeful, at least for a moment. Honestly, my gut tells me he hasn't left Hemphill County, she says. I would think at this point he's hiding somewhere. We just don't know where. I think he's here somewhere, and I don't know if he intends to come out in the next day or two. I don't know. After watching a video of the interviews with Penny, Lewis told his deputies that he was struck by Penny's mention of suicide, but that wasn't the most jarring revelation that day. Another of Lewis's deputies, Jerry Lynn Ortega, stopped into Lewis's office to debrief him after an interview she conducted with Tom's ex-girlfriend, Sage Pennington. Sage had told her something unusual, Ortega said. Sage said that Tom liked to occasionally wear men's diapers. He had confided in her earlier that spring and was clearly embarrassed, she explained. It wasn't clear who else, if anyone, knew. Sage's revelation led Lewis to suspect that Penny was withholding important information about Tom, so he arranged to meet with her again a few days later. This time, she was accompanied by two friends. When they gathered in Lewis's office, he began with a routine update on the investigation. Then, recalled Penny, he confronted her about knowing that Tom wore men's diapers. Penny was incensed. I said, I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't know where you got that information. What are you talking about? Penny went home and told her friends and family that she'd lost trust in Lewis. He was too inexperienced, she said. He didn't even put yellow crime scene tape around the Durango when he inspected it, and now he was trying to trash Tom's reputation. Penny decided she needed to hire a proven private investigator. A friend sent her an article about Philip Klein, the owner of Klein Investigations and Consulting, which is headquartered in a town in Nederland, 90 miles east of Houston. Klein is a celebrity of sorts in the missing persons world. He claims to have investigated more than 1,800 missing persons cases over the last 25 years with an 80% success rate. Penny was confident he could find Tom. She picked up her phone. Part 3, Evil Has Come to Canadian, Texas. So let's go to the beginning of the Thomas Brown case, Klein told me when I went to see him at his office. Leaned back in his leather chair. It's a hell of a case, and I can tell you 100 of these cases that we've done that you would go, oh my God. The 61-year-old Klein is a big guy, 6 feet 6 inches tall and 230 pounds with an outsized personality to match. He's cocksure with a penchant for drama. 2009 NBC show Dateline shadowed Klein as he traveled to Mexico in hopes of tracking down Olivia Newton-John's missing boyfriend, who'd allegedly faked his own drowning. In the broadcast, Dateline correspondent Keith Morrison Riley said about Klein, if you ask him, or even if you don't, he'll tell you he's one of the best there is at finding people who don't want to be found. Klein told me about his initial conversation with Penny. She goes, I've heard about you. I've heard a lot about you. Everybody knows in Texas you're the go-to guy. I said, okay, what's the sheriff's department telling you? Because I'm not going to jump in somebody's backyard if it's being investigated properly. According to Klein, Penny said she was very unhappy with Sheriff Lewis and his deputies. She told me, we need you up here. These people don't know what they're doing, and they're saying stuff that's off the wall. Penny wired Klein's fee to him that day. Neither would reveal the amount, but he charges anywhere between $25,000 and $75,000 to find a missing person. Klein packed a couple of bags, headed to Canada, and went straight to Penny's home to meet the family. He then drove over to the sheriff's department to introduce himself to Lewis. They didn't exactly hit it off. Very arrogant, GQ-ish, Klein cracked when I asked about his first impression of Lewis. He wore golf shirts and a golf pullover that said Hemp Hill County Sheriff, wore a cowboy hat and had the fuzzy beard. You know, not the full beard, but the fuzzy beard. I thought, my God, this is the sheriff. I said, please do your research on myself and my firm. We do this all over the United States and around the world. If you have any issues with me, please pick up the phone. And he laughed. Lewis told me he thought Klein was nothing more than a showboat. He walks in the office and said, Penny's hired me to investigate this case. I'm the biggest and baddest, and I've solved 1,000 cases, recalled Lewis. He was very full of himself. He said there was nothing he couldn't do. That's really all we talked about, which was how good he was. According to Klein, Lewis had already made up his mind about what happened to Tom. He said, I think he's gay. I think he has a fetish of wearing adult diapers and peeing in them. He sat there for 30 minutes and tried to convince me that Tom had run away, that he'd run away from life in Canadian. Lewis denied ever characterizing Tom this way, but he did allow Klein to study the case file, which at that point wasn't very thick. Klein took some notes and left. Over the coming days, he drove around Canadian and visited Tom's friends, recording his conversations. He always began by touting his credentials. I found people in Mexico. I found people in Malaysia. He peppered the teenagers with questions about Tom's life. Did he use a little weed? Use a little meth? He asked about Tom's sexuality. He was extremely attracted to girls, Caleb King told him, and he pushed them to recall details about the last time they saw him. He was fine, Caleb said. He was talkative. There was no sign of him being upset at all. One evening, Klein showed up at the home of Sage Pennington, a friendly teenager with sandy hair the length of her back. Sage told Klein she had met Tom in theater class and had started dating him when she was a senior and he was a junior. One night toward the end of Sage's senior year in the spring of 2016, Tom confessed to Sage that he had been keeping a secret. He then told her about the diapers. Did you think that was weird when he said, I like to wear diapers, Klein asked Sage. Yeah, Sage replied. I mean, I thought it was weird and not appropriate for that age. Klein asked if she told Tom what he was doing was inappropriate. No, I didn't tell him because he already felt so bad about it, Sage said. It really bothered him, and he thought he was a freak because of it. Other than Sage, only a few girls who were close to Tom seemed to know anything about his fetish. Christian told me that Tom told her about the diapers in the summer of 2016. He just told me repeatedly that he really liked it, and it gave him pleasure. Christian said, it had me a little concerned, but a lot of things, these things are natural, and people can't help them. And I mean, if he was handling it in a healthy way, then it didn't really bother me. Penny did acknowledge to me that she had caught her son wearing diapers in the 5th or 6th grade. They belonged to his toddler-age cousins who were visiting from out of town. He would wear them, I guess, kind of off and on for a while, said Penny. And then to my knowledge, he stopped. There was nothing else ever about it again. There were no diapers anywhere. That's why, Penny said, she was stunned when Lewis told her that Tom was still wearing diapers. That had been a non-issue for several years, she said. As for Sage, she knew that Tom was distressed over his desire to wear diapers. She told me that she tried to be a positive balance in his life or to minister to him and help him. I would just tell him, you need to probably talk to somebody professional. go to your parents about it. God loves you. You're not a freak. You don't need to be ashamed of yourself. Everybody has their battles. Said she contemplated breaking up with Tom when she left Canadian to attend West Texas A&M, but she decided against it. She wanted to continue supporting him. She was surprised when, in mid-November, just a few days after he'd driven up to visit her on campus, he called her to tell her that he felt that time had come for them to go their separate ways. He said he was planning to enroll at Oklahoma State University, a five-hour drive from Canyon, which would only increase the physical distance between them. He was characteristically sweet about it, Sage said, going so far as to tell her that he hoped she would find a guy at West Texas A&M who would make her happy. Sage later gave him a lovely handwritten goodbye letter that read in part, "I know God will bless both of us through this." They next saw one another on November 22nd at a Canadian high school basketball game. Sage was back in town for Thanksgiving break. They didn't speak during the game. They sat on opposite sides of the gym. Tom later texted her saying that he was sad and felt like a loser. "I'm sad too," Sage texted back. "I miss you a lot, and you aren't a loser." She texted him the following night, Thanksgiving Eve, just to check up on him, but Tom never replied. When Klein interviewed Sage, he asked if she thought Tom had ever seriously contemplated suicide. She said she wasn't even certain what to think, though she did relate to Klein a story Tom had told her about how he'd once contemplated jumping in front of a train. He was like, "Well, what would happen if I just jumped in front of this train right now?" Sage said, and I told him, "You know, that's not the way out of things. You don't need to do that. So I don't feel like he would have, but I mean, there's no telling." Christian Webb wasn't certain what to think either. That Thanksgiving Eve, she said, Tom had shown no signs of despondence, and he had promised to come over to her house the next day after Thanksgiving dinner. "If you plan to commit suicide, then I don't think you make plans for the following day," she said. Tom's guy friends said that Tom sometimes joked about wanting to kill himself because he had so much homework or because he couldn't understand calculus, but they added lots of kids talk like that. Tom's brother, Tucker, also made an interesting observation. The bank card Penny had given Tom on Thanksgiving Eve was used to purchase 21 gallons of gas at Franck Oil, a local Canadian gas station, at 11:36 p.m., just a few minutes after Tom had said goodbye to Christian. "Why would you go get gas and fill your tank up with gas with your mother's credit card and say, 'Okay, now I've got gas, it's time for me to go kill myself'?" Tucker asked. "That's a little ridiculous." Klein told the teenagers that he too was skeptical of suicide. For one thing, Tom's body hadn't been found, which is rare in cases of suicide. And why would Tom bring so many things with him if that was his plan after parking to Durango? "People that are going to kill themselves don't carry their laptops, their wallet, and their phone," Klein said. In fact, Klein began telling Tom's friends that he had a new theory about the case. He suspected Tom had been kidnapped or murdered. He interviewed Sage. With her parents sitting beside her, Klein suggested that Tom had gotten to know someone on what he called the undernet, not the internet, websites that send users into what Klein called a world of sexual fantasies, sexual fetishes, trading boys for boys, girls for girls, swingers a whole bit, and some very nefarious characters hang out in there. I mean, they're killers. They prey on people. And then you hook up with them. They say, "Okay, I'll come pick you up at midnight. Just be over here on the corner and come pick you up," but you never come home. Or maybe, Klein suggested to Sage and the other teenagers, Tom had encountered someone he knew just before midnight on Thanksgiving Eve, and things had gone wrong. For some reason, that person had murdered Tom, driven the Durango to an unknown area to dump his body, then parked the vehicle at the water treatment plant and walked away. "Makes you want to get over there to the church, get on your knees, and say a few words, right?" Klein asked Caleb after laying out his theories. "Right," Caleb murmured, clearly unnerved. "Welcome to my world," Klein said, his voice low and dramatic. "I do this for a living. You won't meet guys like me very often. I pray you don't. We live in a very dark world. We've seen it all." And then the phone rings and we see one more. Klein paused, letting this sink in. "Evil has come to Canadian, Texas," he said. It wasn't long before the gossip mill of Canadian was churning. Philip Klein, Penny's private detective, believed Tom Brown was a victim of foul play. He reportedly assigned a whole team of his investigators to crack the case, and he brought in another private investigator, a specialist in conducting interviews named James Holmes. That's H-O-L-M-E-S, as in Sherlock Holmes, Klein told me with a laugh. "You can't make this up." Holmes is based outside of Atlanta. She has thick blonde hair and an even thicker southern drawl. Dogged yet understated, she was the perfect counterpoint to Klein's cinematic Sam Spade act. First night she arrived in Canadian, New Year's Eve, she and Klein met a group of high school football players at their favorite hangout, the football stadium parking lot. "So nobody bullied him?" Holmes genially asked the players about Tom's decision to quit the football team. Before anyone could respond, Klein interjected,
nobody wanted to whoop his ass for getting out of football? One of the players replied, "We accepted it. I mean, we told him, it's your decision." Meanwhile, Lewis and his chief deputy, Brent Clapp, also decided to call in for reinforcements. They arranged for the FBI and Texas Rangers to come to Canadian to sift through the case file and help him uncover what had happened to Tom. The lawman quickly homed in on a statement one of Tom's high school friends, Macy Patterson, had given to a deputy. Macy said she and Tom had once discussed how easy it would be to disappear from Canadian as long as you didn't use a cell phone, credit card, or anything else that was traceable. Perhaps, Lewis and the other officers speculated, Tom had skipped town, jumped on a slow-moving train, hitched a ride with a trucker, or had gotten to know someone through Xbox Live who had agreed to help him flee. Once again, Penny was called into the sheriff's department to meet with Lewis, Clapp, and a couple of Texas Rangers. She arrived with Chris and Tom's father, Kelly. Penny told me that the officers asked her if it was possible Tom was gay. Lewis told me he doesn't remember Tom's sexuality being discussed. According to Penny, a Texas Ranger said, I think that your son just ran off. The great news is that he's alive, and when he wants to talk to you again, he'll pick up the phone and call you. Penny said she was stunned. She asked the officers where they had gotten their information. According to Penny, a Ranger said, well, you know, friends. What friends? She pressed. Well, we can't tell you, he said. Ooh, we're already running over. I'm sorry. We're going to stop right there. We'll catch it next week when we resume.
Next, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 96 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the mid-70s. Then tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 70s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 60s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
Coronavirus updates, weekdays at 1.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McGlamory, and I'll be reading Travelin' Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles from the October issue of Texas Highways, and since it's the first of the month, I'll start out with the editor's note by Emily Robert Stone. Tweaking the recipe. A quote from one of our stories this month struck me as an apt metaphor for creating a travel magazine during a pandemic. Texas A&M professor Andrea Botatsu describes the quality of natural wine as reflecting, quote, a sense of place, of time, the conditions of the year. They're an expression of the moment. Typically, our goal is to share stories that are rooted in place but unbound by time, so a reader can pick up any issue at any moment and be inspired to take a trip. In a normal year, that means planning most of our content about 12 months before it publishes, so we can capture seasonal photography and allow writers the time to travel, research, and fine-tune their stories. Perhaps more than any other 2020 edition, our October issue reflects the conditions of this particular year at this particular moment. We had planned a splashy illustrated cover on the State Fair of Texas, but in early July, the State Fair was canceled for the first time since World War II. So instead of a definitive guide, illustrator Mike Lowry soothes our disappointment with an homage to the iconic event. And while the Pilot Point Festival that inspired our Bonnie and Clyde story has also been canceled, writer-at-large Sarah Heppola forged ahead with a nuanced rumination on our complicated fascination with the outlaw couple. I'm proud of the way our contributors and staff have continued to adeptly respond to chaotic times without wavering in their commitment to delivering meaningful and engaging stories about Texas's people and places. When we decided on a pecan pie as our cover star, it was with a nod and a wink to the one thing we've all been able to count on this year, comfort food. While I've made my fair share of banana breads over the past 6 months, I'm looking forward to challenging my baking skills by tackling this renowned Texas dessert. I hope you enjoy this issue with a slice of something sweet. So now let's read that story about pecans, and it's titled Deep Roots, the story of Texas's favorite nut, from planting to pie making, by Laurel Miller. The metal arms of a hydraulic shaker clamp around the trunk of a mature pecan tree, performing a high-speed vibrato lasting nearly a minute. The ripe nuts hit the ground like shrapnel, while the violent quivering of the leaves sounds like hail on aluminum shingles. At Swift River Pecans in Fentress, just outside Lockhart, Troy Swift and his crew are putting in another long day harvesting pecans. Here in Central Texas, the state's pecan epicenter, harvest starts in October and lasts through early January. Each tree is shaken once, and the pecans are collected from the ground by machine and taken to the company's cleaning plant. Swift River is just one of many pecan orchards keeping this integral nut on Texas tables. Pecans' ubiquity in holiday dishes, barbecue pits, and backyards across the state makes it easy to take them for granted. But crack the shell, and you find a story of the state's economy, anthropology, agriculture, and aesthetic writ large. The pecan belt extends from northern Mexico to northern Illinois. Pecans, the only nuts native to North America, are now grown in 15 states. Texas is the nation's third largest producer, after Georgia and New Mexico. By the early 20th century, pecan cultivation was so widespread and successful in Texas, the state legislature designated the pecan tree as the official state tree. Around this time, the hill country town of San Saba declared itself the pecan capital of the world. In a good season, the Texas pecan industry will produce about 50 million pounds of nuts, says Bob Whitney, executive director of the Texas Pecan Board. While pecan farming in Texas is mostly a family business, Swift took up the trade as a second career and has become a respected grower and industry expert. Swift and his wife, Anthanasi Swift, started farming in 1998 after he transitioned from a career in manufacturing. 2 years after purchasing 66 acres by the San Marcos River in Staples, Swift planted pecan trees, hoping they would bear nuts by the time he reached retirement age. Today, he owns two thriving orchards that produce 14 varieties of hybrid pecans and wild native pecans, as well as a busy sawmill. The mill yields lumber from pecan and other hardwood trees, which are coveted by furniture makers and other craftsmen. The extra income allows Swift to retain his employees year-round. The wild pecan trees here are of Caria illinoisensis species, which is indigenous to the pecan belt. Some are more than 200 years old and 100 feet tall. I like working with trees, being in the orchard, and the science behind it all, Swift says, but it's also about being in nature. Indeed, the farm is like a natural cathedral, all filtered light and silence save for the crackle of footfalls and scuffle of small animals and birds. At the edge of Swift's Ventress property lies an improbably green river. A combination of well-draining soil, sun, and moisture provides the ideal environment for pecan trees to thrive, which is why most Texas pecans are grown in or near river valleys. From fossils to family farms. The banks of the Rio Grande have yielded fossilized pecans estimated to be 65 million years old. Based on archaeological evidence, pecans were an important source of dietary fiber and monounsaturated fat for Native Americans in Texas 5,000 or more years ago. Pecan is a corruption of the Algonquin word pecane, a nut requiring a stone to crack its shell. The earliest records of our people talk about the importance of the pecan as a food source, says Ramon Juan Vasquez, executive director of the American Indians in Texas at the Spanish Colonial Missions and a member of the Tapalpilam Coalition Nation. Vasquez notes that pecans, mesquite, and prickly pear were the native foods of the Coahuiltecan and the Spanish explorer Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca wrote of the nuts extensively in his 1544 memoir, La Relación, after he saw how they sustained the native peoples on his travels through Mexico. There's a reverence and sacredness to native foods, says Adán Medrano, a Mexican-American chef, food writer, and documentary filmmaker. They give us a connection to our ancestors, and they make us cognizant of the seasons and of being nourished by Mother Earth. Historians believe Spanish colonists in northern Mexico were the first to actually plant pecan trees. By the mid-1800s, the first propagation using grafts was achieved in Louisiana by an enslaved gardener known only as Anton. This marked the, quote, the beginning of modern pecan culture, according to horticulturist L.J. Grocke and T.E. Thompson. Today, hybridization is used to develop new nut varieties. Once a hybrid has been tested and demonstrates desired qualities, it can be grafted. Using flexible tape and wax, a twig or a shoot from the desired hybrid can be attached to an existing tree, known as rootstock. Once the graft grows, all of the tree above the graft is the new desired variety. The aristocrat of nuts. The hill country town of San Saba is home to a grand towering tree known as the mother pecan. According to the Texas A&M Forest Service's website, it's the source of more important varieties than any other pecan tree in the world, discovered by an Englishman named E.E. Risen, who planted the first commercial pecan nursery in San Saba County. Risen founded the West Texas Pecan Nursery in 1888 and artificially pollinated the mother tree for years, using pollen gathered from male blossoms around the region. He also experimented with budding and grafting. Now, Risen's great-great-grandson, Winston Milliken, is a fifth-generation grower in San Saba. He farms more than 1,000 acres of pecans, while his wife, Kristen Milliken, oversees their store. Milliken Pecan, which sells in-shell and shelled nuts, confections, pies, pecan butter, and roasted pecan syrup. The mother pecan still resides on their private property. Its health has been overseen by horticulturists who estimate its age to be up to 200 years. Like the Billikens, the Berdol family of Cedar Creek, outside Bastrop, has grown pecans for generations. Brothers Dan and Sabi Berdol farm 100 acres, purchased by their father in 1948. Farming is hard work, and you don't always earn a living, Dan says. It's not a come in at 8 a.m., leave at 5 p.m. job, but it's a good life, and I don't have to commute. I step outside my door, I'm at work, I get off my tractor, I'm home. Dan's niece, Jennifer Womack, and her husband, Jared Womack, own and operate Bertle Pecan Candy and Gift Company, located in front of the farm off State Highway 71. Once you see Miss Pearl, the world's largest squirrel statue, you'll know you're there. In addition to their famous gooey pies, the Birdles make fudge, pecan bars, brittle, honey butter, caramels, pralines, and chocolate clusters. Next to the store, workers in the packing house process Birdle pecans to be sold in shell, whole, halved, or incorporated into confections and baked goods. During harvest season, the packing house resembles Willy Wonka's chocolate factory, as workers load hundreds of thousands of pecans into 14-foot hoppers. The pecans then topple onto conveyor belts to be sorted by hand, bagged, and shipped. In sterile rooms surrounding the production area, employees variously dip, stir, whip, pour, bake, and package. The air is heady with the scent of chocolate, butter, and caramelized sugar. More than pie. The Birdalls grow six varieties of pecan, including the much-loved Pawnee, a large, rich, buttery nut with a pleasantly oily finish. In 1955, USDA principal horticulturist H.L. Crane proposed naming the new pecan varieties after the Pecan Belt's Native American tribes. Hence, names like Comanche, Cheyenne, Choctaw, Oconee, Caddo, Nakono, and Lakota. The variation